Hello, everyone.
It's exciting over here at No BS. We have a special guest, and I get to interview her. Just finished her book this morning. So I cannot wait for y'all to meet her. When she gets here, she will raise her hand so I can find her. And we will get started. I did hop on a second early to make sure that everything lined up and was good for her. We are so excited about this call. Let me see if she is here. She is not here yet. Kara Lowenthal will be here with us today, hopefully soon. And we are just thrilled to have her. If you were at our last camp, you got to meet her. She is here and has raised her hand. I am going to introduce her and then I will pull her up, for everybody to get to see her. But let me tell you a little bit about her if you do not know. Kara Lowenthal is our special guest. She is the founder of the School of New Feminist Thought, the host of internationally top-ranked podcast, Unfuck Your Brain, Feminist Self-Help for Everyone. It has 50 million downloads, y'all. And she is also the creator of the Feminist Self-Help Society, a feminist mindset coaching community. Her first book, this is it right here, is an instant national bestseller. Take Back Your Brain, How a Sexist Society Gets in Your Head and How to Get It Out. It was released in May of 2024. And y'all, it immediately landed on the New York Times, USA Today, Publishers Weekly, C-Suite, Amazon, and Barnes and Noble's bestseller charts. She is a friend of this membership, a friend of Corinne, and even mentions her in the, thank yous at the end, which was amazing to hear Corinne's name as I listened to it on Audible. And she has been at camps a couple of times, and we just love her very, very much. Without further ado, let me bring up our amazing guest, Kara Lowenthal. So everyone, get ready.
Hi.
Hello. I do have a word of caution. Because
Okay.
we are No
Tell me.
BS women. And in No BS, we follow the amazing queen, Corinne Crabtree, who speaks a lot slower than you. And so I listen to Corinne on 1.5 times speed, always. But your New York voice
I will
was like
try to
1.2.
speak
I was
slowly.
like, no, when you listen to the book on Audible, I was like, well, I cannot go as fast as I do with Corinne.
Gotta listen to me regular speed. I talk
Yeah.
at an already accelerated speed. You don't have to speed me
Yes. So, first of all, I did finish the book this morning. It was absolutely amazing.
Thank you.
It really, this Southern Baptist girl who's married to a Muslim man from the Middle East, it made me really think about a lot of rules that I have that I did not even realize were like just kind of embedded in me. And I didn't even, I had never even given myself permission to question that there was another way to think. And so a couple of times I paused the book and I was like, that's optional? Wait a minute. I did not even know that I could think something different. So thank you for that. It really did open my eyes to a lot of things. So
I'm
I
so full.
appreciate that. Yes. So I will go ahead and get started. This book, she covers everything from your relationship with your body to sex with others and yourself, finances. Like you go all over the
It's
place.
like
And it
10 books in
was,
one book. I know. I should have done a 10 book deal, but I just put
I
it all.
know it was amazing though, because like if you're not interested in relationships, then maybe you are finance. If you're not interested in sex, then maybe you are in other areas. So, like, really, it doesn't matter what you're working on and what thoughts you want to question or just kind of work through. it really, there is something for everybody in this book. So I really do appreciate that as well. So, all right.
Take back your brain. We just had somebody asking in the chat.
Take back your brain. So, and in there, all the links will be posted when we do this replay. Everything you need to know to get the book. I downloaded it on Audible, like I said, and it was so good. And I gave my daughters a copy.
Oh, great. Thank you.
They need that. Okay. So tell us a little bit about how society, teaches women to avoid their feelings and how we can start to embrace them. And you do cover this in the book as well in a little bit more detail, but
So I think there's two levels to it. One is the socialization that I feel like all Americans at least get, which is sort of like, you're always supposed to be happy. Everything's always supposed to feel good. If you're ever like sad or lonely or anxious, like something's gone wrong or there's something wrong with you. So we're all socialized with a kind of like just unrealistic view of how we're supposed to feel. And we get that like from very early on. You know, you see people saying to their kids, well-meaningly, like, don't cry, don't be upset. Like, you know, so we get that message anyway. And then I think women get a really complicated set of conflicting kind of social messages. And this is something that's consistent through a lot of the social messages women get, is that we'll get like conflicting messages that are impossible to square in the same area, so that we always feel like we're doing it wrong. And so in the emotional world, on the one hand, we're told that like women are naturally good at emotions and like naturally relational, as opposed to men who are supposedly like, I don't know, robots who only feel angry or sexual desire. Like but then on the other hand, there's a very long history in Western society of women being stereotyped as irrational and too emotional. And so there's this real like push-pull where women are socialized to sort of not trust their emotions and think that sort of second guess themselves constantly about their emotions and think that their emotions are like misleading or irrational or that they're overly sensitive. And society reinforces this. Like if I asked a room full of any coaching students, did you hear you were too sensitive growing up? It's like everybody's hand will go up. But like so many women heard that. So I think we get this really like conflicting soup kind of different messages. And then so we end up like, we don't think we're supposed to have negative emotions. We are supposedly more emotional, like biologically, that's what we're taught. But also our emotions are like bad and not shouldn't be trusted and are irrational. So that's very confusing. And then we end up often like either we're avoiding our emotions or we're like giving into them too much and not questioning them at all and not looking at them at all. And I think women especially get into this cycle of feeling like part of the reason that we want validation so much is like, we don't believe that we're just allowed to have a feeling just because we have it. It's like, it has to be valid. Like 12 people have to agree that you're allowed to feel that way. And that like, that's the right emotion to have in this situation, right? That's why you like text all your friends and then you get like 6 opinions and like, you still don't feel sure. So you text 3 more people, right? It's like, we never just, there's just so many layers of like self-judgment and analysis on top of what is actually just a set of physical sensations happening in your body that they aren't necessarily true or untrue. They aren't valid or invalid. Like they're not irrational or rational. There is just physical sensations happening in your body because you're an animal, but we've layered all of this conflicting socialization on top. And then we have this very push-pull, like avoidant relationship with our own emotions.
Yeah. And we see it a lot in the membership. People will get on calls and cry. And they're like, I'm so sorry. I was trying not to do that. Like,
right. I know. I told myself I shouldn't cry or
yes.
I know I shouldn't feel this way. Like that's like saying, I know I shouldn't release this digestive enzyme in my intestines or something. Like,
yeah,
it's just a physical thing your body does, but we have this whole morality and distrust of it built on top of it.
Yeah. And I feel like for women too, it's like, if you're over emotional, like you were talking about, it's bad or you're too emotional. And for me, I'm not the nurturer and I'm just not. And then I'm heartless. Mm-hmm. You're one or the other. It's like, and both of them are bad.
Right.
So, and then nobody ever tells you what the mix is supposed to be.
There's no way to win. Right. It's like sex. It's like you should be sexy, but don't be too sexy. That's slutty. But then if you aren't sexy at all and you don't care about that, then you let yourself go and that's bad. It's like impossible to find. It's not designed to be solvable. It's designed to be like an unsolvable Rubik's cube so that you're always doing it wrong.
Right.
and you and spend then all your
how
time.
How do you get, like, what can you tell yourself to give you, give yourself permission to have a feeling, to feel the feelings?
Yeah. So in the book, I talk about what I call the three R's of emotion, which are like three different ways we can respond to an emotion, essentially, which is to resist, react, or to receive. And so resist looks like when we just shut it down, compartmentalize it. Like my partner is a you know, straight, tall, white dude raised in the Midwest. And before I met him, I think he had just taken 53 years of emotion and just like shoved them into a dark corner of his brain where he never went. Like, that's just like, this isn't happening. I don't have this. I'm going to go do some things around the house until it goes away. That doesn't work long term, obviously. Like, builds up stress in your body. It's not good for your health. And they don't really ever go away. Reacting is when we're taking an action to try to get rid of the emotion. So that could look like, I mean, obviously a big one is numbing out. So obviously there's a lot of talk about emotional eating in the membership. Like, that's a kind of reaction to an emotion of like, I don't want to feel this. I want to numb out or zone out. So I'm going to use food. People use, they drink, they take drugs, they watch Netflix, they compulsively shop, like any kind of compulsive behavior that's trying to like get away from our feelings. Or when we try to sort of like take action to solve a problem really fast and deal with a feeling. So, you know, it's like you send off a bunch of texts that you like later regret and wish you'd calm down, or you yell at your kid or your partner. Like, those are all reactions to emotions. And when we're reactive, we're also not really willing to have the emotion. We're like trying to do a thing to get rid of it. And then the third option, which is what I recommend, is what I call receiving an emotion, which is, you might call it like processing an emotion or feeling your feelings, or these are all different words for the same things. But I really like the word receive because it just helps my brain understand what I'm trying to do. Because when I used to hear like, feel your feelings, I was sort of like, I don't, what does that mean? Yeah. Right. And like, even with, I was trained with process your emotion. And in some ways that language is helpful, but then in other ways it makes it feel like the emotion should be done. It's like, I'm supposed to do the thing and then the emotion's supposed to be through. Like, I process this chicken. I like process this feeling.
Yeah.
And what I like about receive is that it just sort of like reminds my brain. It's almost like a physical, like this, like you're going to, it's like, oh, I'm going to receive it. I'm going to like let the emotion land or let the emotion be here. It sort of just helps me remember that what I'm really trying to do is not get rid of the emotion. I'm just trying to allow it to exist in my body the same way that like, if I have a headache, that's just a somewhat unpleasant sensation that exists in my body right now. It's not an emergency. And the same is true for a feeling. So in terms of like, what can you thought to be, what can you practice thinking to like increase your willingness, kind of, I really use thoughts like, I'm willing to feel this, I'm willing to have this emotion, or I'm willing to tolerate this emotion, or I don't want to have this emotion, but I'm willing to try. Like, I'm a big believer in very small step thoughts. So don't try to gaslight yourself that you're so excited to feel all your feelings, because you're probably not.
Yeah.
But like, are you willing to tolerate it for 3 minutes? That's like a more achievable goal.
Yeah, for sure. Like urges and everything else. It's like a wave. Like, it will come and then it will leave.
Yeah.
Like, it just, you can just let it ride. Just ride it out.
Let it ride. Yeah.
Yeah. Let it ride.
Ride's a good one.
And this was the next question I'm asking you about was one of my favorite things. And I think it can apply to way more than body image. Mm-hmm. Because something came to my mind when I was reading the book. Talk about body image, magical thinking.
Yes. Yeah. This applies to so many things in life.
Yeah.
So I define magical thinking as a little different than how like psychologists define it. The way I define it in our coaching work context is the belief that when X thing happens, or I get this thing, when this circumstance changes, then I have arrived at the promised land. I feel blissful forever and ever. It's an exit ramp off the human experience. And I never have to like feel lonely or annoyed at my partner or hate my life again. Right. And that is magical thinking. It's like when I just hit my goal weight, when I just get the operation to remove the loose skin after I hit my goal weight, when I just get my hair done, when I just somehow reverse aging on my face, like whatever, all of these things. And people absolutely do this with like money, with relationships. If I just, you know, got married, if we just have a kid, if I just make a certain amount of money, if we just had a house, if we just had if I just, right? And the magical thinking is like, when you imagine yourself in that space, this is an easy test. When you imagine yourself in that circumstance that you are so wanting, do you imagine yourself like having a bad body image day and feeling pissed at your partner or your kid and maybe eaten one too many cupcakes because you didn't, because you're emotionally, like, you don't ever imagine yourself in your real life in that scenario. In your mind, when you reach your goal weight, all of a sudden your life is like Breakfast at Tiffany's. Like, you live in Paris and you never have a bad hair day and you look like Audrey Hepburn and you're never sad again. And that is magical thinking, right? That, and so what you see often is, like, it can operate two ways. For some people, it blocks them from ever getting to the goal because there's just way too much pressure on it. And because when you tell yourself, oh, I'm trying to do this so that I can be blissfully happy, it doesn't feel blissfully happy on the way. So your brain is like, fuck this. What's the point, right? Some people do manage to push through that and they get to the goal. And then they're like completely devastated because they finally got the thing that was supposed to fix all their feelings of inadequacy or self-worth or whatever, and it didn't fix them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it so just sets yourself up for...
Yeah, it screws you either way, whether you... It either makes it hard to get the thing, or when you get the thing, it's then... I mean, I know a friend of mine is a coach who made her first seven figures after years of trying, and then she spent like 3 weeks crying because it didn't solve the emotional problem.
Yeah. For sure. And I was even thinking about it. Like, I do this, I'm doing this with my vacation. So if I pay for their flights and if I book the room with the balcony suite and if I upgrade their drink package and I get them the super fast Wi-Fi, it is going to, nobody's going to argue. It's going to be, and then I end up like going into debt for this vacation. And it's like, and when I was reading that, I was like, I have so done that with this damn vacation.
Oh my God. Vacations are such a thing. I'm going on vacation tomorrow. And for sure, part of my brain is like, I'm sure I'll have no negative emotions when I'm on vacation.
Yeah. But
there's,
we do
studies
it with so
showing
many things.
That people, that people enjoy vacation, the anticipation of the vacation more than the vacation.
Yes.
And I'm like, that totally makes sense. So now I just let myself really enjoy the anticipation. I'm like, this is a fan, but I know it's a fantasy. So I'm not upset when it, like, I know right now that that is a fantasy. And then tomorrow I'm totally going to be like, oh, why is my partner doing this thing?
So yeah.
The problem is when you
daughters.
Don't,
I'm taking
the
them
problem
on
is when you don't know that it's a fantasy.
Yeah. But it was like, it almost like hit me. I was like, I do it every year and I'm doing it again. And then this time, that's exactly whenever I was reading that, I was like, I'm doing it again.
Oh my
and then
God.
I was like, I'm just going to enjoy the lead up. Just like you said, like, I'm just going to enjoy the ride to get there. And know that they're going to argue and whatever. But
and that's socialization too, because women are socialized to try to manage everybody else's emotions. Mm-hmm. Like, I was having the same thought process because I'm getting married in July and we're taking some family and friends on like a group honeymoon. And I have like a lot, you know, family with a lot of opinions about what rooms everybody's going to get. So I'm like trying to get the perfect plan where nobody will be upset and nobody's going to fight. It's the same thing. And just literally today, I was like, what am I doing? Of course they're going to like, be annoyed and fight and whatever. And like, this is not, I don't need that to not happen to enjoy my honeymoon. And I'm not in charge of controlling that. But women are socialized to believe that it's their job to keep everybody else happy at all times and to manage everyone else. And so that comes so naturally to us, quote unquote, it feels so natural because we've been taught from the day we were born that that's our job in life.
And then when it's your job and then they argue or fight or
it's
something,
like, I did it
wrong.
Know,
like it's supposed like, to. Then I end up having a crappy time. Like, and then I think, like, what else could I have done? Maybe if I would have done this, it would have been different. Or
if I got them the platinum package, not the silver package then.
Yes, exactly. And then you take it on yourself.
Right.
Because you're just expecting that I've done it, or you just get bitter. Well, I did all this and they don't appreciate anything. And then you just turn into a.
Right. They're bitch. Wrong or I'm wrong. One of those.
Yes.
Two.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Which is, that was what that like got me in this book for sure. This is really good because we talk about this a lot in the membership. Why are we so afraid to be like subconsciously to be nice to ourselves?
Oh yeah.
Oh
so
God.
I think we are taught to believe that being mean to yourself is what motivates yourself. So like we're all supposed to be like Marine Corps drill sergeants, and that if you're nice to yourself, you will just become a lazy sloth who lies on the couch and doesn't want to do anything, which like, first of all, it's okay to lie on the couch. Like, why is that a bad outcome? I love lying on the couch, or I like lying in my bed, but I love laying down. That's one of my best parts of my days. So like, number one, why is that bad? But it is really this, like, this is why I think that life coaching is really about like deep philosophical questions. It's like, what is human nature? The idea that you have to beat yourself up to get yourself to do anything relies on a vision of human nature that implies that humans are naturally prone to sloth, idleness, selfishness, arrogance, right? It's this very actually dark vision of humanity. It's a specifically Christian vision of humanity, like not necessarily every person's individual denomination who's on this call, but in terms of like, what was the mainstream Christian theology that shaped all the, you know, mostly men who created like the philosophy and laws and rules of our world, was this belief that like people are inherently fallen, right? And so we need to like put the fear of God into people to like get them to be productive, upstanding, you know, nice members of society. And that without rules and shame and should and obligation, you know, life would be a state of chaos, state of nature. So this is like goes back to debates between Rousseau and Locke, like two, you know, Enlightenment philosophers. And I just don't believe that's true. I think if you look at little kids, you see that that's not true. Little kids are naturally curious, active, interested in like building things with blocks, wanting to share their snack with you. Like little kids are naturally relational and creative and compassionate. I mean, yeah, as kids grow up, they have to learn a little bit more empathy and like other humans exist. That's a normal part of the brain development. But I just refuse to believe, and it hasn't been my experience, that driving yourself with cruelty gets you better results. And so I think a lot of people, because that's the only thing they've ever done, their thought process is, well, if I didn't do that, I would like, that's responsible for where I've gotten so far. And I always say, like, what if we contemplate the idea that the opposite might be true? What if anything you've accomplished so far is despite the way you talk to yourself, not because of the way you talk to yourself? Mm-hmm. Because outside of weight, I hear this all the time from my clients who are like, you know, high achieving, very professionally accomplished people who are like, well, no, I have to beat myself up because like, that's what got me through law school. And that's how I win the cases. And that's what keeps me going as a doctor or whatever. And I'm like, oh, what if not? What if like you've managed to do all of that despite this terrible way you're talking to yourself that's actually making your life so much worse?
And if you think, like, I always say this inside the membership, there's a lady I don't like at all. Like, I don't like her. And, you know, I would not, as they say in the South, I would not pee on her if she was on fire. So if she called me right now and said, hey, can you do something for me? I don't care if I am sitting on the couch. The answer is going to be no, because she, I don't like her. But then I have my best friend who, if she called, I would drop everything. I would run. I would take care of her. I would do everything for her because I love her. And so it works, but for whatever reason, we don't think it works inside of us. But it really is, you're not going to ever take care of somebody that you absolutely despise, but somebody that you love and you foster that relationship and you nurture it. It's like, yeah, I would do anything for them.
I mean, I think that some people, especially women, are socialized in such a way that they do end up taking care of people they don't like. Like,
yeah, they
have more boundaries there than a lot of people do.
Yeah.
But the way that I like, so that's because of that socialization, that it's your obligation, right, to do whatever anybody else wants. But the way that I like, I will be coaching people who are talking about how, you know, the way that their parents criticize them has resulted in them like wanting to get coaching and therapy. Then they're like, so I need to keep talking to myself that way. That's like what's motivating me, right? It's like, no, that's the same thought pattern that traumatized you. And now you're doing it to yourself, right? I mean, it's just this, if you substitute yourself for a child or a dog, it would be very obvious to you that like berating and screaming at the child or the dog, or telling them they were worthless or useless or lazy pieces of shit or couldn't get their life together or whatever, would not have a good effect on that person's psychology. But with us, we're like, oh no, I'm just, you know, I'm giving myself tough love.
Which is just, that was one piece that when I joined No BS, I really did, like, that was the best thing. Is I finally learned, I finally heard it, first of all, like how bad it sounded in my head. And then, but you still, even though I speak kinder to myself, those old thoughts still come back. And I'm like, girl, what are you doing right now? Mm-hmm. No, don't do that. So, why do positive thinking and affirmations not work, and what does work?
So this is always like you know, if they work for you, that's great. What I experienced with a lot of people is that positive thinking affirmations don't work because your brain doesn't believe those thoughts yet. So I think for most of us, if you, I can say any thought in my brain, I can say like the lizard people built the pyramids. Like I can say the words. I'm not getting any emotional payoff from that. I don't believe it. I don't have any emotional reaction. And so affirmations and positive thinking can be similar. You're trying to think something. It's like a thought someone else gave you, or a thought that like looks good on paper and you wish you believed it, but you don't. But people don't really even know that they don't believe a thought. So they think a thought a few times and then nothing happens. And then they're like, oh, okay, this doesn't work, right? Like positive thinking doesn't work or affirmations don't work. And so I think that that's really the problem is like people are so desperate to change their thinking that we tend to skip over the part where we have to actually see if we believe the thought. And at least this is how I teach coaching. Like you have to check in with your body to see if there's any change in your emotional state. And I always say we're going for like 10% less shitty, right? Like we're not trying to, the thought is not, the thought that's right for you right now probably won't look great on an Instagram background. It's like just a 10% less shitty thought, but you will actually get some physical relief in the emotion in your body, and that will provide a positive feedback loop for your brain so that your brain learns that this is worth doing, and then you can build on it from there. So to answer somebody who asked the questions, what happened to fake it till you make it? Like, I don't personally teach that because I don't think that it works. I've coached women in the C-suite who have been faking it till they make it for 30 years. They've obviously made it. They're now the CEO of a multinational corporation and they're still having the same thoughts. Like we all know from coaching that your external circumstance does not determine how you think and feel. And so many women are kind of faking it through life, like doing what society has told them they have to do in order to be accepted or be loved while having this like terrible internal monologue the whole time.
And I mean, you can, I think a lot of times too, fake it till you make it, you say it out loud, but you don't feel it. You don't internalize it. It's not something that you believe. And, you know, we've talked before in the membership, those ladder thoughts, Corinne's been calling them lately, stepping stone thoughts. Like maybe, you know, the aspirational thought is where you want to be at some point. You may get there, you may not, but you have to start on the next pebble. You
Fake it till you
can't.
make it is like what happens in a Ponzi scheme. And then eventually the Ponzi scheme collapses.
But you can't, you know, and you don't really even know. Like you don't know where you're going to end up. That's the
Yeah,
beauty
totally.
of it, right? So you find the thought that you believe, and then who knows? The next thought you believe, you may try it out, and the rock in the pond is wobbly, and you're like, oh, not that one. I'm going to go over this way, and you try a different pebble,
Totally,
and then
yeah.
eventually you make it to the other side, or you don't,
Or you
right?
go
Like
somewhere else random. Like you don't
you
even know
go
where your brain's going to
random.
lead you. Yeah.
And you
Yeah, like
talked
right
about.
now, your brain right now probably can't even conceive of the great thought you're going to think in the future.
That's exactly right.
But it can see the next 10%.
Yes. And you talk about that in the book, about how you speak about your body, like body acceptance, body love, all that kind of stuff. Like, and you gave a really good example of you can have like, I love what my body does for me, or that I move, or I don't remember the exact quote, but it's like, and there are things I don't like about it. And I don't like this thing. And like, that is okay to have that thought and to rely, because you're at least giving yourself credit for something instead of I suck.
Yeah, or
Right.
instead of pretending, I would much rather that your thought is a true thought you can believe, which is like, I don't like how my body looks right now, but I am grateful that it keeps me alive. Like that's a more true thought for you right now, potentially, than like, I'm so grateful for the miracle of my body every day. Like you don't believe that. That's a thought you think you should think or sounds good or would be nice to think or somebody said in an Instagram caption or whatever. But it doesn't emotionally resonate. The only thing I will say is I would, when you're doing a like kind of and thought, I almost call that, right? Sort of like this and that, is to start with the negative one and end on the positive. But you can experiment. Some people it works better the other way. For me, if I start with the positive and end on the negative, that's like the flavor I'm left with kind of. But it depends. It d depends. For some people, if they start with a negative, they then feel like they're starting out in a slump. So you just gotta, but like check your body. It's things are so unique to you. I mean, this is the other thing. It's like, I'm sure Corinne experiences this and you experience this and I experience this. People think like, well, if I could just talk to you, you'd tell me the perfect thought to think. And I'm like, I don't fucking know what you should think. I can give you some like templates or ideas, but if you see me coach, like I will go through 10 thoughts with somebody, like being like, how does that one feel in your body? What about this one? We got like, it's so individual. And women are not socialized to see themselves as authorities. Like we are socialized to believe that somebody else is always the authority. It's probably a man. We don't know what we're doing. Like we can't be trusted to make decisions. We need other experts to tell us what to do. And I think a big important part of this work, like in whether you're working on your weight loss or whatever you're working on, is to like work on believing in your own ability and authority to make the decisions for yourself. Like Corinne doesn't tell you what to eat. That you got to decide and figure out what you're going to eat for you. Like you have to decide and figure out, you know, what kind of career you really want or what kind of relationship you really want. And all of that is, you know, we don't believe we have any say over it. I was just coaching, like, I don't coach weight loss. So, but I was just coaching somebody in my membership who was like having a lot of trouble around like her relationship because she was like, well, I don't know. It's like, this is what society says marriage is. And I don't want that. So I don't know, you know, what else is there sort of, right? And like coaching, it's like the same as the coaching would have been around like what to eat. It's like, you have to figure out for yourself what you want that to look like and learn to believe that you're allowed to do that. And not that like someone else has to tell you what's acceptable or what your options are or what's allowed for you.
And I think that we do come up upon that a lot. Like, do you just plan what you like? I don't know what I like. I don't even know. Like what?
Yeah.
It's because like, you know, you have all that, those diet rules that come in and like, even if you do write down something that you like, it's still bad and you can't have it and you shouldn't have it.
I want to like do, I don't know if it'd be like a video. It's like, I want to produce this visual depiction of what it's like to be a woman in society where like the minute you wake up, there's like 17 headlines about every moment of your day telling you 13 conflicting things about how you should be doing it. Like, how you should sleep and what your morning routine should be and like what skincare you should be using and what can you wear or not wear based on your body type or your age or what should your, are you probably washing your hair wrong and then eating for breakfast? Like you're definitely doing that wrong. It's like, you've only gotten through the first hour of your day and there's already like 600,000 conflicting opinions about how you're doing everything wrong.
Yeah.
So like, of course you feel like you don't have any idea how to even feed yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a miracle we make it out of the house every day with all of that.
Totally.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we see that so often. And it's like, you know, what have you been eating? Well, I can't eat that. Well, is that what you like? It is. Well, then eat that. But then it's just like this internal, like just this turmoil because we don't learn to trust ourselves.
Yeah.
Growing up.
Almost every, sure. I feel like sometimes the bottom line of all the coaching I'm doing is someone's thought is I'm doing this wrong. Like women just essentially think they're always doing everything wrong.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it, I know, but then I think we think we're doing it wrong a lot. First of all, because I was always told that I could do it better. I was doing, if you would have just done this or if you'd only that, like that's how I was raised.
Yeah.
And then like you said, like we do internalize other things around us and our friends are doing it this way. And then this person says it should be this way. And it is just so confusing. And then we just end up not even knowing what we believe anymore.
Women are social. We're socialized to think there's a right way to do it, right? And there's studies showing that parents use the word perfect more for little girls than little boys. So girls are praised more for being perfect, like coloring perfectly within the lines or following the directions perfectly, or that parents are more likely to swoop in and rescue a little girl if she's having trouble or having a challenge with something, whereas they'll let little boys like kind of rough and tumble it out, figure it out, make a mistake. So it's like bred in so early. And it's not that our parents are thinking she's a girl. So it's like so embedded in our culture, right? But it just shows you like how early you're being taught that like what you're supposed to do as a woman is play it safe, stay within the lines, be perfect. And then get praised by other people for doing that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's, Rebecca says, I equate someone else's unhappiness, dissatisfaction with what I've done it wrong.
Right. We're responsible for the feelings of everyone we've ever met. And this other comment is great. I've lost 70 pounds and I still tell myself, well, she says I still don't feel like I know what I'm doing. I would say you still have the thought and tell yourself you don't know what you're doing. But that's a perfect example. Like I coach people all the time. We're like, I don't know how to do this. And when I coach them, I'm like, you're literally doing it. What are you talking about? You're doing it right now. You're already doing it. right? But their thought, like, that's what's so crazy about the brain. You can literally be like running a marathon with the thought, I don't know how to run a marathon. I'll never be able to run a marathon. And like your body's physically currently doing it. And your brain can be so out of whack with that.
Yeah. Robin says, I feel like, you know, I still don't believe I've done it right. Well, who decides what's right, Robin?
Right. And who cares?
Yeah. So what if you did, you did something.
I feel like so often so much of the coaching is like well-intended, but it's like, I sort of, maybe it's a self-coaching, whatever, but I sort of see people coming in being like, okay, well, I'm trying to coach myself to believe that like I did do it right. Or like, I can do it how I want. And so I'm just like, okay, so what if you did it wrong? So what if you're bad at this? So what? Like, men are allowed to do things wrong and be bad at things and not succeed all the time. So are we. Like, the most powerful coaching to me, for people socialize as women, is what if I am bad at this or did something wrong and I'm still going to love myself and be nice to myself? Like, yeah. It's not, let me learn how to believe I did everything right. It's like, well, I'm allowed to fuck up. I'm a human. I'm allowed to make a mistake. I'm allowed to do it wrong. Whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Robin said, I ate McDonald's, lots of carbs and chocolate, and lost 65 pounds. I think you need to write a course on weight loss, Robin.
I mean, if you were marketing a course called How to Eat McDonald's, Carbs and Chocolate and Lose 65 Pounds, I think you'd get a lot of signups.
I know. You would be like, yeah, we would be interviewing you. So is it only if we feel it's part of our identity or an expert that we are not skilled at something or can state we know how to do something, we figure it out along the way?
I think I need that question asked again because I don't totally understand it. I will say that I think that women often, they disguise their perfectionism in a kind of belief in like a sort of, I just need to be better skilled, or I just need to something. Like, I just coached somebody the other day who has been a coach for 15 years getting their clients results, who has all these thoughts about how they need more skills. And I was like, what if you don't? Why do we, it's like, we think we have to be the best in the world. This is like my thing I'm obsessed with right now. Like, we don't all have to be yo-yo mom. Like, we don't all have to be the best in the world, right? And for the person asking about men bashing, I'm not bashing men. I'm talking about the messages that patriarchy gives us, that like living in a society that was created by men in the vast majority of the cases, and that has been built to privilege men. For instance, as you've heard if you read the book, like, it was not until 1974 that a woman could get a credit card without a male co-signing it in every state in the country. And it wasn't until 1986, in the 80s, that a woman could get a business loan in every state in the country without a male co-signing it, right? So that's what we're talking about. Like, the society was built in a certain way that teaches us that men and women are different and unequal. It is not about not liking men as individuals. I am engaged to a man. He's great. But he's also influenced by his patriarchy, and so am I. And to men's detriment, we're socialized to think that like men shouldn't cry or show weakness, or that their job is, I was just coaching a woman earlier today about how her thoughts were sexist about her husband in a way she wasn't aware of, because she equated his worth with his career. And that if he got fired, then like he lost worth, and then she lost worth, and that, right? Like, that's patriarchal sexist socialization too, that we conflate women with like their appearance and their service to others, and that's their value. And then we equate men's value with their career, money, and all of these things that are also, you know, flattening of them as humans. It's like, patriarchy is bad for everybody.
Yeah. Dolly says, how do we verify our own mindset on our way to improving our thought life?
How do we verify our own? I'm not sure what it means to verify our own mindset. If you can clarify that.
Yeah.
Yes, we can all write it down. Somebody said, there's a question above. Oh, that's what I was going to say about skills and expertise. Like, I obviously think that, improving your skills is great, of course. I think there's an important distinction that I actually borrow from my colleague, Brenda Lomelli, who put it this way, which I love, which was that expertise can be very valuable and important. Like, I go to the doctor if I'm sick. I don't have a medical degree. But we have to be the authority in our own lives, right? For instance, if you go to the doctor and you get gaslit, which happens a lot to fat people and to women, and especially to fat women, right? They're going to be the expert. And they may be saying to you like, well, this would all just be solved if you lost weight, or just, this is what it's like to be a woman of your age, or whatever. We have to be the own authority in our lives to be like, I don't know, that doesn't feel right. Like, it's not, I don't think it is that. Or like, you know, how would you treat someone who is thin who had this problem? Or like, what are the other options? So it's not in sort of both directions. Like, I think we could get overly fixated on our own skills in the sense that we're like, if I'm just the best at this, I'm perfect at it, and I have the highest level skill, I won't feel insecure and nobody will be mad at me ever. But also, like, believing your own authority doesn't mean like you don't respect expertise or skills from somewhere else, but it means that like ultimately you're the one who has to take care of you and look out for you. Like, no one else is, you know, the experts aren't going to do that for you. You have to be there for yourself.
But what we see all the time too, like, I love it when women advocate and speak up for what they want, but then we are also conditioned to believe that it's complaining.
Yeah.
You don't want to complain, you know, like,
don't be so touchy. Don't be so sensitive.
If I question them, you know, like,
it's just, humor.
Yeah, for sure. So it's like, yeah, it's like, because people write in all the time. They're like, I'm so, in email, I am so sorry to have to ask you this. I'm like, girl, I'll be sorry. I love what you're doing. Like, ask away. Yeah. Ask away.
There's some good things happening in the comments. Let's see. Somebody said, yeah, somebody's husband, when I diagnosed with AFib the whole time because he was just told to lose weight. Right. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But I love that what Annette said, because she says that she was a corporate controller and she was told as a woman that she didn't provide as much value, so she changed jobs. This is really important because one of the, I think, most insidious ways that like society gets to us is that people who are marginalized are told that like they're worthless and so they're lucky to have whatever they have. So like, if you're a fat woman and you're in a relationship where someone's not treating you well, like no one else is going to want you, so you should like make do with what you have, right? Like, don't just resign yourself, make the best of it. If you are a woman in a sexist and a job with a sexist boss, well, everywhere's like that, and at least you have a job and like you shouldn't go looking for another, right? So we sort of, part of the fucked up socialization is being told that like everyone everywhere thinks like this, and therefore there's like no better place and no point to standing up or demanding or asking for more, right? And that part is not true. Like, there are jobs that will respect you and pay you equally as a woman. There are jobs, there are people who will find you sexy and appealing as a fat person. There are, like, there is a better world out there. It's already there. But one of the most insidious things is when we like internalize all that kind of shame and all that scarcity. And then we think, well, you know, there's no point in believing better than in myself, even. Like, some people will be like, well, even if I believe better in myself, everyone else thinks this. And it's like, it's actually not everyone. Yeah, it's some people, it's a lot of people, but it's not everyone.
Yeah, for sure. We have a couple in the Q&A. Yeah. Terry just got diagnosed with complex PTSD. How do I even feel things for myself and not in reaction to others? I'm 60 and I feel like my life has been a waste. You do talk about people with diagnoses in the book as well.
Yeah. I mean, so you got diagnosed. That means you're getting professional care, which is always what I recommend. If you have trauma or PTSD, and especially if you see PTSD, like, you're going to want some trauma therapy. And I think coaching tools can be helpful, but are not the only thing that you need. In terms of feelings, especially, I think you're going to want to get some, you know, some version of EMDR or other PTSD specific therapy, because that sort of body brain safety connection is kind of damaged by the trauma. The place I think you can already be using thought work is like, how are you talking to yourself about the trauma, about the PTSD, about the symptoms? Like, often there's like gaslighting of ourselves, like, maybe it wasn't really that bad, or I shouldn't really be having this problem. Or there's catastrophizing of like, these symptoms are like going to ruin my life and I'm not gonna be able to have the whatever that I want. They're gonna get in the way of this. I won't be able to have the job I want. I won't be able to have the relationship I want, or I won't be able to lose weight, like whatever the thing is. So just like notice like any story you have about the diagnosis. That's a place that you can really be using thought work right away, I think, even if you need to get some, you know, more specialized therapy around the kind of how to feel safe in your body, having emotion stuff, which I think is, you know, trauma specific therapy would be helpful for. Dolly clarified her question. How can we strengthen our confidence with where we're at today as we try to build on success and failures, become stronger? I mean, I think it's like it's thought change to me. It's like, what's your thought right now about yourself? What's your thought about failing, right? I also kind of love a few more successes than failures, because my experience as an entrepreneur is that you have 10 failures for every one success you have. Like, that's, you actually have way more failures than you have successes. So the first thought I would start with is that one. Why do I have to have more successes than failures? Like, think about that also with weight. Like, are you willing to like fail the not eat according to your plan 10 times before you learn to do it once, and then another 9 times before you're able to do it twice in a row? Like, are you willing to keep showing up and have more failures than successes, especially in the beginning?
Yeah, for sure. Leslie says, so what if there isn't anything you like about your body? I haven't liked mine for literally all my life.
Yeah, you don't need to like it. In the book, I talk about the first body image thought I used was, this is a human stomach, which was very factual and true. Did not have anything to do with liking it. I did not like it at all. So I don't think you need to like I talk about neutral thoughts a lot. And those are just like just a statement of fact often. Like, my body keeps me alive. Even if that's what you're practicing, you're still doing two things. Number one, you are just, if you think about, it's like every time you think the thoughts that you're used to thinking, your brain, you can imagine it like a muscle. Obviously the brain's not really a muscle, but it's like strengthening that neural network. It's making that network even more efficient. And your brain likes to go the route of efficiency. So just giving your brain something else to think is, at least now we're sending the energy down a different path rather than making this one even stronger. So number one, it's just giving your brain something else to think. Number two, it's getting you in the habit of just sort of observing a neutral circumstance rather than evaluating it and giving a negative judgment and opinion of it. And so that is already going to feel a little bit better. Like, this is a human stomach felt a little bit better than my stomach is disgusting, right? So I'm like giving myself a little bit of an emotional break, and I'm learning to think about myself in a more neutral way. And then eventually, like, you may work up to more positive thoughts, or maybe not. But you don't have to like anything. You can just start with really factual thoughts. Another thought I used a lot was, lots of people have a stomach that looks like this. It's also just factual. Like, other, and if I didn't believe lots, I could have just thought, there are other stomachs that look like this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And someone says, can you address noticing I'm getting more wrinkles? I would just say, why are wrinkles a problem? I just heard this great interview with, it was Diane von Furstenberg. There's a new documentary out about her, I think, the fashion designer. And she looks like the older woman that she is. She has like a normal person face. And she kind of talks about how she doesn't want to erase her experiences. Like, her face is her experience and her like record of those experiences. And she doesn't want to erase that. I mean, for me, like, I am 43, and a lot of the people my age that I know are getting Botox, getting fillers, getting whatever. And I'm not shaming anyone for their choices. Like, I, you know, this is not how my hair naturally looks. Like, I had it curled. We're all complicit in these beauty norms. But my thought about that is, like, I want to see what my older woman face looks like. I want to know myself, my like real self. And so I want, like, somebody use the phrase crone's body, which I love the crone. I talk about the idea of the crone a lot and the power of the crone in society. Like, I want to meet my crone face. Like, I want to see who that person is, and I want to know that person. So I think it's, you know, the premise that wrinkles are bad is totally optional. And when I look at my grandmother's face, like, I think it's beautiful how long she's lived. I'm not like, well, she is 97, and so she should really have a smooth, planed face. Like, I just think this, you know, the focus on the negative story about women and aging is like so sexist and so damaging, because it is literally a thing that you cannot control or stop. You are aging irrevocably on a molecular level at every moment. Yeah. And it is just such a way of making women feel that they are, you know, unworthy and of diminishing relevance, diminishing importance. And I really think we have that story precisely because older women are actually so powerful. Like, they are kind of post-menopause, you hear a lot of women talk about just being like, oh, all of a sudden I give so many fewer fucks, and I don't care what people think about me as much. And I certainly don't care what like the 35-year-old named Chad thinks about me. And like, they actually feel so much more powerful. And I don't think it's a coincidence that society is like trying to make women that age feel invisible or kind of irrelevant, because actually that's when so many women are like coming into their power. They have more, you know, if they've had children, their children are grown, they have more time and energy and resources and wisdom. And that's when society is like, go hide in the cave, you crone, don't come out unless you're wrinkle free. So
yeah,
fuck that noise.
It's the same thing with, I mean, this gray hair of mine that I colored forever and ever and ever, because I just knew I couldn't go gray. I will never go gray. I will color, I will die with some rinse in my hair, some kind of color. And then COVID said, bitch, you can't go to the beauty salon. And I was like, what do you mean? So I just let it go. And I have loved it. And I was like, it was just, and I don't think, I don't know. I just love it. And I'm like, I am so glad. First of all, it's saving me a shit ton of money. And it's just so what we're so afraid of, you know?
Yeah.
Let's see. I just had an aha moment, which makes sense to me now, instead of defending my thoughts. When I was raising my sons to keep them out of trouble, I told them to keep their heads down and keep your nose clean. And all these years later, my first son is 45, and he said how that was me taking care of me and keeping him from growing as he needed to. And certainly he did learn his own independence on his own. But that was me thinking with my female brain and conditioning from my youth. I will be thinking about this now for future consideration and conversations with him today. My book is being delivered today. You're going to love it.
So I wanted, there are people saying like, oh, I wish I could embrace the gray. And I just want to make sure that I'm being really clear about this, because one thing women love to do is shame themselves, right? So I like listening to this, if your thought is like, oh, I should embrace my gray, but I'm just not confident enough, I'm doing something wrong. Like, first of all, I think that we are all complicit in beauty norms in different ways. They're pretty impossible to escape. And I think like, if you look at the, you know, anthropologically, like humans have always, for whatever reason, I don't know, maybe because we're like peacocks, been into like, had an aesthetic sense, like have been into body modification, like native tribes will have piercings or tattoos to mark certain rites and certain passages, or to mark if you're married or not. Like, this is just a thing humans do, just like, you know, birds do mating dances. So to like some extent, there just seems to be something hardwired towards like, having social norms and adoring ourselves. To me, the big question is like, is it determining whether I'm willing to be visible and be seen? So like, I wear red lipstick sometimes, but I'm very willing to go out of the house without it on, right? I don't feel that I can't be, I'm not allowed to like be in public or be with my partner or be at a party looking like just what my face looks like. So to me, that's the big difference. Like, it's not, don't wear makeup, it's not feminist. It's the point is like, the feminist part to me is like, I don't want you to feel that your natural face is unacceptable, that you cannot feel good about yourself, or you cannot show yourself to other people if you are not performing these rites to society satisfaction. Like, that's what matters. It's not, don't ever do anything to yourself appearance wise. It's just, are you making your self-esteem dependent on it? And just to really think about it. Like, when we say, oh, I just feel better me when I do it, that's a shallow level analysis. The reason you feel better that way is you've been socialized heavily that this is what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to look. So I'm just encouraging people to like do that real inquiry and see where they're comfortable. And like, I'm comfortable buying, and this is just my line, like I'm comfortable buying face cream and not injecting botulism, and someone else will be somewhere else on that. And that's fine. Like, we're all our own authority. Like,
And you have to do like, because this hair is brought to you by God, but this face is brought to you by Botox and filler.
Right. Of course. And like, Corinne is one of my dear friends. Like, and you know, we have different beliefs on this. It's just, I want everyone to decide that for themselves. And some people are going to be like, I love the Botox. And some people are going to be like, you know what? I don't even want to shave my legs or wear makeup at all. That's what's, you know, I just want women to take that authority for themselves, to like, not from a perfectionistic should point of view, but from a really like, if I know, like, I want to know that I'll still feel like I'm confident to show up the way I am post-apocalypse if I can't get my hands on a curling iron. Like, I prefer my hair this way, but I'm not, you know, like, I'm, I'll stop on this. This is like my soapbox, but like, I'm going to Italy on my honeymoon with like some family, with family and friends. And I don't do this myself. I have someone come do it. But for me, I'm like, I'm fine with that. Cause I know that, for instance, I'm going to Italy for a week and my hair is just going to be in a bun or frizzy, and that's not going to bother me. Yeah. But I would be uncomfortable with that if I was like, okay, no, I got to like drive 3 hours to find a place I can do a blowout, because like, I can't have my husband after our wedding see my real frizzy hair. That's the difference to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And if I couldn't make my Botox appointment, I'd be okay. But I'd
be like, you wouldn't be like, well, no, honey, you have to don't look upon me because
I can't do
I
Zoom.
Have a furrow
Take
in
me
my
off
forehead.
the calendar, Corinne.
Right,
I can't do
exactly.
it.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
Can you please comment on, yeah, this is an important question. In the world where age, gender, and look discrimination is very much a reality, how's it possible to stay confident that my natural wrinkled face is acceptable? So I think this goes back to what I was saying before, which is like, it is true that structural discrimination and oppression exist, which is what we're saying here, right? Like people are judging you based on age, people, you know, there's ageism in the workplace. And it's also not true that that's everywhere. And that's the part that is so like insidious that we absorb is like, not only do these social norms and standards exist, but the idea that they're everywhere. So there's no point. If you try to not conform, you will lose your job and die alone and no one will love you. And like, there's nowhere any better. And so you better conform. Like that's the message we get. And I know for a fact that's not true. There's rampant size discrimination in the dating market. And I'm about to get married to a also very conventionally good-looking man who did not even understand that I was like what a life coach was or that I made any money when he met me, who actually just likes larger, like likes my body. And that is, he exists. It took me longer to find him, right? I was dating in a world in New York where like dating profiles say, you know, height, weight, proportional only, no fatties, like active only, whatever. And I'm a body positive. I don't teach or coach weight loss. I don't try to lose weight myself. So I could have looked at that and been like, this is fucking hopeless. I'm never going to find anybody, right? But I do this work. And I was like, no, I just need one person. And I'm not going to believe what society's telling me, which is that no one would want me. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that. And I'm going to keep going till I find my person. And so the same thing, you might decide to compromise. But it's still also different. Like, listen, this is the last thing I'll say. We're close on time, but I think this is really important. What do we know from coaching? It's not the action line, it's the thought line, right? So if you decide to dye your hair because you make a calculated, confident decision that this is the industry I'm in, this seems to be required, I like everything else about this industry, I'm willing to do this, maybe I'll try to change some norms while I'm here, but I'm going to do it. And I have my own back in that decision. And I know I could take care of myself if I made the other decision. Like that feels very different than like, I have to do this or everybody will think I'm old, but I don't want to, but I'm being forced to. It's like owning your agency and your choices.
Yeah, for sure. Anonymous had a really good question. Her daughter decided to quit shaving her legs. It's her body and she doesn't say anything, but how do you like notice that you're judging and kind of stop judging, or does everybody just judge? Like, talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I think the question would be like, what are your judging thoughts about that? Right. I mean, I actually have found that thinking about the social and historical context, I see really helps women make peace with their own mothers and with how they've parented. When you think about the fact that until, you know, 50 years ago, till 150 years ago, absolutely, you like needed a man to survive. So of course, generations and generations of mothers have been like, this is how you need to look and this is how you need to act, because like literally, I'm just trying to teach you what you need to survive. So just understanding like the depth of that programming, I think, makes it easier to understand why, if we see like our child transgressing those norms or something that we were taught were like basically essential for survival and really used to be, to understand like why that's so hard for us to just, you can almost see, it's like this person's thinking, I'm being judgmental. And like, yes. And also maybe you're actually being loving. That doesn't mean that you should then tell her not to do it. But it's like understanding your own motivation kind of like, oh, this was programmed into me so deeply. And for women, these norms have been programmed in as like survival norms. So it makes sense that I'm having a really hard time with this. Now, like, where do I need to shift my thinking in terms of what I make this mean? Like maybe I make it mean that it's like not ladylike, it's not attractive, that it's important and good to be ladylike, that this is what it means to be attractive for a woman. And like, those are some thoughts I can work on changing. But as soon as you tell yourself you're being judgmental, then you feel shame and then you feel guilty. And then you got to coach yourself on all that before you can even get to the underlying thought.
Yeah. And it's, I think what's so good about this comment is, you know, that it's not something that you want to give to her, a thought that you want to offer to her. It's like, I know this is me and I'm going to let her be her.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to work on myself, which is amazing. Like that is just so amazing. And all of our women in the membership always want to know, what can I journal on? What can I write about? Mm-hmm. I will tell you, this is not only a book. This is like, there are journal prompts and exercises for every single topic that she brings up. And I told you, finances, like, I mean, literally everything. She like goes all over. So
there's a whole chapter on self-confidence and external validation, which is like at the heart of so much of this. And then body, money, time management, and like household labor stuff, sex, relationships, dating, everything. It's very concrete and actionable. It's like little it history, is. Little sociology, little thought work, little exercise. It's got everything.
Yes. So, I mean, it's like, not only is she telling you, but then she is teaching you how to take that piece and uncover what that means for yourself and what you're making it mean about you. And really it kind of just takes you on a journey through that topic. So, it is amazing. Again, take back your brain, how a sexist society gets you in your head and how to get it out. Cara Lowenthal, good luck on your upcoming wedding.
Thank you
so much for being here. We really do appreciate it. And I am telling y'all, if you've not already gotten the book, go get the book. It is amazing. And get it for I bought it for all three of my daughters.
Thank you.
So
thanks for having me. That comment about wanting to ride at dawn, whenever I talk, I'm taking that with me. So
I know. And from the amazing Mickey Jack, she is an
Thank
amazing.
Thank you so much. No, I am not doing the no BS program. I don't know where that dot, dot, dot was going, but no, I don't teach her. I don't personally try to.
She's
I love all of you and I love Corinne. Yes.
And please listen to our podcast, Unfuck Your Brain. It is an amazing podcast. You can find her there. All right. Thank you, Cara.
All right. Bye,
I appreciate it.
I love you too. Bye.
Bye.